Good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon to you. So, me and you have dialed into and done a deep diving into issues around self-care, self-awareness, how the family lineage affects us. And I just wanted to take a deeper dive into this aspect of caretaking versus caregiving. And as the names denote, caretaking is a negative in this language, something that was shown to me a couple of years ago. And because something is taken from us. And to pick up where we left off in terms of the lineage stuff, you know, when we were raised by narcissists or caregivers at a young age, like many have spoken about in the past, that are checked out or not self-aware enough. What happens is one becomes a caretaker, meaning one starts caretaking out of obligation because we can only feel worthy or safe when we're taken care of, starting from our original caregivers, who are actually not capable, which caregiving is a positive aspect, right? So we end up wanting to take care of others as a way of we take care of them. They get well, and then they'll take care of us. That's how the unconscious works. But the way it actually works out is we caretake, and we don't ever get our needs met. So one of the things that happens at that young age is we start denying our own needs. We aren't even aware that we have needs, right? So we start tap dancing. And one of the ways one becomes aware that one's caretaking as opposed to caregiving is we get depleted. It leads to feelings of resentment. And again, unconsciously, we're doing this to get loved, right? And it's not honest. So we start taking responsibility for somebody else's well-being. And then we become angry. And then we actually get into a relationship either being punished because the person who's doing the caretaking, who's on the receiving end of it, who's actually, it's hustling us, not being an honest relationship, it actually damages the relationship. So then a level of punishment comes in, certainly in my experience. And to explain the caregiving part, we're not looking for external validation like we are when we're caretaking, right? So it's honest. It's pure. It flows. There are no hard feelings. And again, we can do it and let it go. There's not a sense of obligation there, right? And it's a gift that we give that not only doesn't deplete us or take away from us, or our inner child, it actually feeds us. And part of the caretaking thing is like there's a middleman. Like we want to take care of another, so then they get healthy, they take care of us. So part of the invitation in this conversation is how do we cut out the middleman? How do we not do this as a way of tending to our needs, a fake way of it? And how do we actually tend to our own needs instead of fixing another? As a way of getting our needs met.
That's a very compassionate introduction to the theme, because when I and I mean, we're not being I sometimes look back at our videos, our recordings of what we do, and I see how we're laughing about this stuff. So, and it's, I think it comes, I hope it comes through that we've got master's degrees in caretaking, and
I would say postdoctorate, but you're being kind.
Right. We have huge experience with this in relationships and even in our work. So, we've come to a place where we've explored them so much that, you know, we can take them with such lightness and love and embrace them and, you know, have fun with them. So we don't mean to belittle anybody, obviously, when we laugh about this stuff. And the
Well
moment I
said.
started taking notes about today's talk, I noticed that the first thing that I wrote down was a really essential but brutal definition of the distinction. So what's caretaking? It's being selfish masked as being selfless,
Oh, good one. Good
which can
one.
sound, you know, it can hurt. because obviously, as you rightfully said, in this environment, in this field, the term caretaking has a negative connotation. As ego, for example, you know, we talk about ego in specific terms in the spiritual world rather than the psychoanalytical terms. But unless we are talking about infants, the elderly, the sick or the disabled, where they literally need someone to take care of them because they're unable to take care of themselves, caretaking is never a healthy approach. Because it starts, and I think that is very important because it happens many times, it starts from the principle that the other person is unable to take care of themselves. And it's a totally independent decision. I choose, I decided that you are unable to take care of yourself. You don't know what you need, so I'm going to do it for you. Which speaks volumes about our childhood, you know. We had to do that in hoping to get validation and love back. We had to take care of mom's or dad's needs before they even mentioned them. So I think there is an element that is sort of a common denominator in this kind of situation, which is the element of despair. Caretaking is very much fear and pain driven. And so once again, I know we're saying this all the time, but that's where it all starts, is how does that feel? If we are resentful after having taken care of someone, if we're angry for whatever reason, if it doesn't feel love-driven like caregiving is, then I think the first step towards learning how to create this distinction, because obviously we're never in only one or only the other, and the two tend to melt, especially if we have a job in the healthcare environment, or we, you know, do our volunteers for a dog shelter for homeless people, then the things really get mixed up. But I think that the first step is recognizing the fact that, I'm, you know, I'm taking care of people, I'm giving so much, and yet it feels like shit. I'm angry, I'm resentful, I'm in pain, I feel lonely, I feel not seen. So to me, that is a first step.
So many great points you put out here, and let's unpack them piece at a time. So first off, pretty much everyone, as someone who's been a healer for a long time, who's taught healing, pretty much everyone I've come across, and this is thousands and thousands of people who's in a care, healthcare, caregiving business, has this wounding.
Yeah.
Meaning they learned at a very young age to caretake, which is very unhealthy.
Right.
But that I would also include, you know, as someone who loves animals, whose friends are very involved with animal welfare, it's the same thing. That's another way of being in the healthcare business, right? It's like, it's just with more helpless beings, which is these animals who the culture treats, you know, so horribly in so many ways. Yeah. So pretty much everyone that we're talking to here would be well advised to look at this. Where is it? And we don't really have good models for it, right? We don't have good models for caregiving. Now, you said something really important that should also be addressed. When we're in situations as a first-time, second-time parent where you're with this helpless being, that is actually your job. When you're with an elder parent, it might not be pleasant. That's still your job. But even in those places, we can work on caregiving as opposed to caretaking. And we'll get into, I mean, part of what's really important, as you said beautifully, is to check with our emotional state.
Yeah.
Am I resentful? Am I angry? When I'm working with young parents or people who are parents for the first time, I'm always drumming this. I know you have zero time to even scratch your head, but you taking care of yourself is going to actually help being more of a present parent.
Yeah.
You know, I deal with a lot of people who have special needs animals or special needs kids. And it's, again, taking care of self really becomes less, and people always have that default saying, well, I have no time. Where actually that time that you give yourself actually helps the other being on the other side of your love, which is what it's supposed to be. And There are questions we can ask ourselves. Am I in caretaking or caregiving? Mm-hmm. And again, we're making special considerations here for people who are in relationship with someone who's just pure need and can't take care of themselves. Again, like you said, elderly, young child, an animal.
Yeah.
And some of these questions would be, am I putting the needs of others ahead of my own? Mm-hmm. Right. So again, with a child or with an elderly, again, we put this aside for a second, just take it more into a generalized population that we're dealing with. That's a very common thing. And again, like we talk about, we spoke two talks ago, many times we don't even know what our needs are.
Right.
We're not even aware of them.
Right.
Another good marker is, am I feeling emotionally drained after my interaction? Mm-hmm. I see this all the time with people. I certainly did this for decades, you know. Before text, I'd be on the phone, you know, after work for hours with quote unquote friends or some on and on and on. And I'd feel so exhausted.
Yeah.
Another one is my sense of identity tied in with another. You know, we become controlling of the other.
Yeah.
I can't believe he's doing this. I can't believe he's still drinking coffee after I said, your adrenals are shot. You know, it's just, we really get tied in with the other.
Yeah.
And then to your point that you said earlier, you know, am I feeling angry? Am I feeling frustrated? Mm-hmm. Again, the sitting with what we're feeling afterwards is a great marker, especially when we're starting on this path of what is it? Which part is my part of this and which is the part of this? And the hustle is real.
Yeah.
Right? So a lot of times when we're in these relationships, again, a child and a parent or, you know, elderly parent or an animal is different. But when you're with humans that you're interacting with, there's always going to be a narcissist on one side, which is one way of dealing with trauma, right? Getting your need met by stealing, basically. Mm-hmm. And then the flip side of that coin is you getting your needs met and by being the, you know, savior. And again, both parties suffer here because there's a dishonesty with it. No one's taking the power within themselves.
Yeah.
My job is to take care of myself and then I can give. The person of the narcissist, their job is to actually self-care, not to go into this hustle that they do.
Yeah.
And it's a lose-lose situation, right? And this topic comes up a lot. I'm sure it does for you too, especially in the healing circles.
Yeah,
the whole burnout syndrome in healers comes from this place where they're caretaking instead of caregiving.
Yeah.
Right? And then those of us who have this wounding, we certainly feel selfish when we're doing self-care. It feels wrong.
Yeah.
Right? As a child, you were going to die unless you tap danced and became a circus bear, you know, standing on your hind legs when you couldn't even stand on your hind legs as a way of getting your needs met.
Yeah. And what's so tricky about this is the fact that you believe that you're empathizing with the other person and well feeling said. What they're feeling and what they need when you're actually connected only to your need. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing is that you're taking care of the other person's need, or that's what you tell yourself you're doing. You're actually thinking about your own need, because your own need to caretake comes before the other person's need for you to, you know, care, give whatever.
Wonderful.
So there's this really disconnection between what do I really need? What is my real need? Because I'm so focused on what I could give the other person that I, you know, I stop looking at my own self. And something that is very indicative is that there's very little dialogue. There's very little asking. What do you need? No, it's, I just barge in and say, you need this. Yes. You should do this. Yes. Oh, here's something. I made this for you. I did this for you. There's really a depersonalization. It's you're objectifying the other person. And that's why it's not heart-driven. And it's really hard to recognize because you're doing, well, I'm doing good. You know, how can this not be love-driven?
Yes. So it's really great. So to tease out what you just said, which is very profound, is that the level of anxiety we live with, our emotional needs when they're not met at a young age, it becomes such a hot potato that we want to toss it out.
Yeah.
So I know my own experience, as well as my friends or healers that I know, I used to seek out people who were in these emotional distress because I was so out of touch and so afraid of having needs. Yeah. Because again, when you can't even feed yourself as a young child or shelter yourself, the level of tap dance is very hard to appreciate this. I say this all the time, very hard to appreciate how absolutely frightening it was.
Yeah.
So it becomes such a hot potato that, you know, people are anxious. Anxiety is such a thing. The anxiety is so intense, right? We medicated this and that. It still doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to dig deeper, like, where's this anxiety coming from?
Yeah.
Right? Until we get in touch with that, part of it is just look at our actions.
Mm-mm.
You know, I, all the time with like friends, it would be like, I cannot believe it. I was on the phone with this person or myself an hour. And then sure enough, the next day, right back into it.
Yeah.
So part of it is the hustle of the other party because they don't know how to take care of themselves. But boy, strong 50% is our abject terror
yeah.
of actually, what happens if you don't do that? Because it's a form of getting high.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if you're not getting high? You have to feel your own anxiety. So yeah. this piece of like, you know, when you say, what are my needs? Start with the anxiety that comes up when you're not returning that text or that email or driving that half an hour to listen to the same story for the 300th time where the person is doing the same thing and then being angry at it.
Yeah.
So all these things that come up have to just, we just have to be attentive to it. Once again, awareness is the key to unlock this seemingly mysterious lock.
Absolutely.
Just paying attention.
And many times that's what we would do. That's what we do in sessions, you know? So tell me about your anger. Let's go there. Let's go there. Let's stay with it. But many times it's, I don't know if you've noticed, but it's, there are not many caretakers. You know, they come to session only for separate stuff.
Totally.
They don't come for that because it's something that, and me myself, you know, I didn't go to therapy because of my caretaking habit. It's because after a breakup, I would totally collapse. And then from there, I would start seeing my caretaking addiction.
It's such a great point you're making. I never put it that way, but it's a great point. You know, I remember when I was, this is going back 40 years now, when I was getting recovery for drugs and this and that, and I kind of, you know, part of it was, and it was actually a stronger movement then, but the codependency thing was really big. And I remember doing this, you know, CODA and these codependency anonymous meetings, and I was like, oh my God, drugs wasn't my problem. It was caretaking. It was the pain. It was so mind-blowingly revealing to me that I hadn't looked at that was actually using chemicals because I didn't know how to say no. I didn't know. And, you know, intellectually being aware of it, it took another couple of decades to even start wrestling with it.
Yeah.
And I would say it's only really now as, you know, as man in his 60s that I can actually even know. I say yes and I got like back up. But like even at this point, after doing all these decades of work, of still having to tease out, whoa, I just got hustled there. Or I became unconscious to allow myself, right? We're not victims here.
Yeah.
But the codependency thing, which is really what we're talking about here, it is a profound wounding, especially for those of us who have had this sort of tainted love at a young age.
Yeah.
Right? It looks like milk, but there's some cyanide in it.
Yeah.
And you're not quite dead, but your hair is falling out. You're like, I wonder what I'm feeling. And I'm turning green. Like, what's going on here? So it's really profound what you say. It's really one of the last things we come up across. And again, to reiterate this point, when this wounding occurs at a very young age, it really feels like unless you do the tap dance, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Right? It's very hard to appreciate that as an adult.
Yeah.
Unless Ian or Abdi shoves down his knees at a young age. And mom, how are you feeling? What's going on? Are you okay? What can I do for you? Did you have a rough day, dad? When that comes at a young age, the default setting takes quite some time to actually become aware of and then to actually start standing up to it.
Yes.
And then, you know, the talk we had about the superego, these cultural imprints really keep that in check. Don't you dare say no. Don't you dare step out of that.
Right.
Right. So again, it becomes this very massive energy that we have the courage to stand up against.
Yeah.
And then it only comes through when you're like literally on the verge of killing yourself because you're so exhausted. And even then, you know, we'll have 100 of those breakdowns. And at one point you're like, well, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
So I would also say for people who are listening or watching this, it's another invitation not to let it to get to that point.
Yeah.
Right. Of just being like, wait a minute. Actually, I need to like say no. One of the things that I say to people who start doing this work is when people ask you something, start getting in the habit of saying, let me think about it.
Right.
Even if it's something that you really think you want to do.
Yeah.
buy yourself a little bit of time. Actually, yes. Make that a habit.
Yeah.
Hey, can we have a conversation today after work? Hey, I'm busy right now. Let me think about it.
Mm-mm.
Right? And just to start buying yourself some time, and then that gives you a little bit of room of going like, I'm actually tired. Yeah, I still can't say no. I just register that I'm very exhausted.
Right.
But I still feel responsible. But just that alone, that even 30 seconds, starts the ball rolling.
Yeah. Because at that time as children, that's where we start developing shame around our own needs.
Great.
So it's an automatic response. My need comes after anybody else's need.
Yes. Yes. And that shame word is so important, right? This is another thing I share with people. You know, anger, grief, these are emotions. Shame is this very interesting human-made concept to get us stuck so we don't move. So we're shamed, right? I'm going to shame you because culturally, again, talk about the superego. I'm going to shame you. So this is like wood glue. It's just to get you stuck so you actually don't shift.
Right.
Right? It's a very powerful thing. Not in a healthy way. It's a way to keep us in check.
Yeah.
Right. And then the common question that comes up when we talk about this stuff, I'm sure it does for you too. People go like, well, I'm being selfish.
Right.
But we're not talking about selfish here. That's the narcissistic thing. Again, to your point, same side as a caretaker. We're talking about self-care. So the language always like, I'm being selfish. A person who's a caretaker, right? Yes, they have that wounding, but to be selfish, you're about 1,000 kilometers away from that to get to a place of selfishness. Selfishness is dysfunction. We're talking about self-care.
Yeah.
And for anyone who's in this mode, I remember for me when I was starting my healing work, I remember where people like, you know, with the AIDS patients that didn't want to do something, taking care, I would get so angry. Like that was their sense of self-care.
Yeah.
So also there's an anger that comes up when someone's doing self-care, if you're codependent or a caretaker. Because it really triggers something. And yeah, I remember I used to get rageful, like, how dare you not want to do this? But that was their business.
Right.
That was their choice. They were afraid of getting AIDS. So I can understand as a 62-year-old, as a 22-year-old, I was like, well, go fuck yourself. What do you mean you don't want to take care of these? These are human. Like, but that was my thing.
Yeah.
My soul's journey was to take care of these beautiful men. That wasn't somebody else's. But why was I getting so triggered?
Mm-mm.
Whereas now, someone doesn't want to do something. People tell me all the time, it's too much for me to deal with cancer patients. I can handle it. They can't. I don't get angry. So also understand when this kind of rage comes up.
Yeah.
Is telling you you're protecting something very deeply.
Yes.
So it's always these two things come up. Selfishness. And then people get really angry when you start touching this very gently. You know, like, no, this is sacred. We don't talk about it. This is who I am.
Right.
Everyone's so selfish in this culture.
Yeah.
Again, we're not talking about narcissism. We're not talking about giving zero damns about somebody else.
Yeah,
we're talking about a win-win situation. It always has to be win-win.
Yeah.
Right? I'm a limited being with limited resources. This is how much I can put.
Yeah.
Right? I can tithe away this much of my energy.
Yeah.
And then I replenish and I come back to the table.
Right.
And then there's another piece to this, which me and you have talked about before, is trusting spirit. Not in some woo-woo new agey way. That actually when we make room, it's amazing how other avenues come in for the person to be cared for. So part of very tied into the early childhood wounding is we have zero trust in anything, right? It's just, and again, because the experience was so horrendous.
Yeah.
So this is, again, an unconscious thing.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not talking some woo-woo thing, and I'm not talking about an emergency where somebody needs something. We have to forget about ourselves for a second.
Yeah.
Many people would do well to do that. But the people we're talking about here who have this wounding, it'd be more that. You're not the divine. The divine's got this.
Yeah. Yeah. The I know better.
Yes.
And yes. I can see, and I keep using that model that I've come to, you know, to use throughout the years of, you know, spirit, mind, emotion, and heart. To me, those are four such important pieces. And when we talk about caretaking, it feels so much this combo of mental and, you know, just from the belly. It's totally emotional, totally instinctive, totally reactive. It's mind and belly, mind and belly. It feels, I feel a strong emotion, so I got to do this, I got to do this. We don't stop to feel, we don't stop to think, we just act immediately. And The opposite, if we want to call caregiving the opposite, is heart and spirit.
It's wonderful.
So there's that embrace, there's that welcoming piece of, okay, yeah, that's you.
How does it, so break, that's really wonderful what you're saying. Break that down. How does it feel in your body, the first and the latter?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's really, really, they're really distinct, and yet they're not easy. It takes a, it takes some practice. But if we start from the emotional part, the part of me that wants, that reacts possibly to situations, it's really intense. It's really strong. I feel, you know, this, my body is compelled to move. It's really instinctive. And the mind has that flip side of numbing down. It's like, I know better. So I feel this urge and my mind says, do that. And that's something that we could do in sessions as well. And that I might do in the past, you know, it's like, oh, I feel this urgency. I'll tell you to do this. You're telling me something. You're telling me you're suffering about this or that. Immediately, since I can't stand that, I immediately tell you to do this or do that. I'm hypermobilized immediately. And then I get resentful if the next time you come back and tell me you didn't do that, obviously. The moment I talk about heart and spirit, which are the others, and I mean, even visually, it's like spirit on the top of the head, if we want to place it there. Obviously, it's not where it lies necessarily. And heart, and then mind. And to me, it's in the belly. It's in, it's really in the bottom, in the pelvis, the second chakra, the whole part of emotion. And when we're talking about heart and spirit, things slow down. There's not that sense of urgency. There's that patience. There's that softness. There's that saying, okay, it's not a matter of life or death. I'm not in the OR. I don't have to do something immediately or else, even though that other part tells you that. Everything slows down. You know that you don't have to save anybody.
Yes. The slowing down piece is so profound. So this is what I'm saying about, let me think about it. That's part of
what
I came up with. You know, it's like we literally get into this point where we just want to jump into it.
And hypermobilize.
It's hypermobilize. And again, there's such a dishonesty in it because we push away our needs. Mm-hmm. Again, this goes back to that part of like, you know, the anxiety around having needs for those of us who've had this early childhood wounding, which everyone has to some extent, but for some of us it's more severe.
Yeah.
Again, I always want to stress this point. It's so easy to talk about this stuff as adults. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to have compassion for how absolutely terrified the child was.
Yeah.
Right? It's survival. It's not like, oh, I want to be loved. I don't know how to be loved. Like as a child, when we say you're not getting the proper care through love, you literally will die as a child, as an infant, as a young child. Everything is dependent on the outside.
Yeah.
So one has to have profound compassion. How this tap dancing was survival, is survival. Mm-hmm. And again, the body mind does not have time. Right. It's still in that timeless place of just terror.
Correct.
Terror.
It won't even take the time to breathe.
So that's the thing that I always talk about with the breathing. I mean, you talk about it as well. You know, we breathe abdominally as young kids, as infants. And that's the soft belly. And one of the first ways that we push against the pain, the terror, is we stop breathing from the belly. We go to this thoracic breathing, which is, you know, such a less quantity of air as a way of literally shutting down our emotional body. Mm. I mean, we're committing harakiri, as the Japanese say. We're cutting the hara. We're committing. It's a form of suicide, but it's a form of emotional numbing.
Yeah.
Right? So we actually try to numb the body down by bringing more juice into the system.
Yeah.
So we turn the battery down from 100 to like 25. It's really that significant. Mm-mm. So again, as we talk about these issues, really important to have compassion. Really be soft with yourself.
Yeah.
This came from a deep place of not anxiety. Anxiety secondary is terror.
Yeah.
And then becomes this underlying anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah. And something that to me is very helpful, especially when when working with people, but even when observing myself, and I think that might help others, is if I take, you know, the perspective of, you know, mind and body, where we're hypermobilized, what are the images that I work with that fuel this behavior? Because if I, you know, taking back from Eva Pierakos's work with pathwork, you know, she says that when we use words like always, never, all, and none, there are images at work. So the belief systems. And do I find myself being exasperated and saying stuff like, I will always have to take care of everything. Nobody ever helps me. All these absolutes are very useful elements for us to notice. Oh, okay, that's what's going on within me.
That always really struck me, of all the lectures, the path work we were talking about, that always struck me. It's so profound.
Yeah.
Because we kind of build this castle in the sky with them. It's like sandcastles, but boy, they seem really real. And again, paying attention to language is so profound.
Yeah.
So well said that. And again, this goes back to the terror. We want to build these absolutes because, again, it's this sense of it. And again, part of this is to make room for our helplessness, which is, boy, difficult business.
Yeah.
Because it comes back as an adult. These are words. But again, to go back to the experience of helplessness as a child, it was not pleasant business.
Yeah.
It wasn't pleasant business. And then, you know, a side street to this caretaking is it's a really dishonest way of being in the world. It's a real begging for love. It's really giving up our royalty to live as beggars.
Yeah.
Right? Really giving up the divine self for some weird image of what was forced down our throat. Yeah. So it's a very dishonest way of being in the world. And that in itself builds up a very unconscious anger towards self, towards others, towards the divine.
Yeah.
Right? At the end of the day, even in most glorious places, you know, people do these medicine journeys, which can be very wonderful, or MDMA. I'm in love. But really, that experience is not the normal experience. The normal experience is terror. I'm alone. I'm not cared for. Unless I tap dance, I will die.
Yeah.
That is pretty much my experience of thousands and thousands of my own self and thousands of people that I've had the good fortune of sharing their journey with. It's really that. Yeah. It's really that we have that. So again, people are hearing the words. This is, again, an invitation to gently delve into. You know, maybe I'm not an asshole if I'm angry. Maybe there's a place here where I didn't know. And not as judgment, not as self-berating. Let me examine this. Let me examine and see where this is coming from.
Yeah.
I know for me, when these things were coming up, I'm a very loving, soft guy in a lot of ways, but I was angry all the time. And then the moniker becomes like, you're an angry guy. And then you take it on, I'm an angry guy. But when I look back, I wasn't an angry person. I didn't know how to self-care.
Yeah.
I would get into this dishonest relationships with lovers or friends where I would do this thing and it would feel good for a moment. It's literally like doing drugs. It feels good for like half an hour.
Yeah.
And then you feel like shit for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Right? The high is like, oh, they called me. They need me. Right? People who have this issue can relate to this. There's a moment of where you puff up. Right? And it's this thing, but it's a high price to pay.
Yeah.
It's like doing coke. It's like you have this, or drinking a strong cup of coffee if you don't do drugs. It's this high, but then you really feel terrible really quickly. But then you go back for the next hit. And then becomes this really dysfunctional relationship with the other person because they don't feel good. They feel your warmth for a second, but they're feeling the resentment. They're feeling the anger unconsciously.
Right.
And it becomes this cycle.
Right.
Right. So they become more desperate. And then you get more resentful as you give. And then either something breaks. But, you know, I know myself, I was like that. I know you've been like that. We've talked about it. But I have patients who will do this for decades.
Yeah.
And and they'll come into, they'll come to a session to get some relief, not even knowing that's what they're coming to relief for. They're talking about something else. And I'm like, oh, my God, I got this one person.
Exactly.
3 fucking hours this week on the phone and then texting. I'm in the middle of work. They're still texting me. It's like, yeah, but where is your part in this?
Yeah.
You're not a victim to this. And these are not stupid people. This is really coming from a place of, again, abject terror and helplessness and not knowing.
Yeah.
Right? And then how do you circumvent this? Part of it, as we're saying, pay attention to the feelings that come up.
Yeah.
Part of it is like, what are your needs? How are you tending to them?
Mm-hmm.
Right? People, again, aren't aware of that. You know, it's not just going to the gym. That's a wonderful start. But where are the places we have some downtime? You know, even in these extreme cases, when you have a sick animal or where you have an elderly parent or you have a newborn child, still self-care has to be a part of that. Especially when it feels like there's no other way, but I got to do this 24/7. There's got to be half an hour in there dispersed where there's some level of self-care.
Yeah.
And again, if you're in a marathon like that and you never did it before, it's a tall order, but you still have to pay attention to it.
Yeah. And especially if you're a healthcare professional, it's going to be so hard to recognize how you're, you know, keep running into the hamster wheel and, you know, fueling that addiction, or it's, hey, it's my job. I can't stop it. So it's really about feeling, you know, how does that feel? Because it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to stop doing whatever job you're doing, because caregiving can be so rewarding. So if you're in any kind of role in this sense, you're a nurse, you're a doctor, you're a psychiatrist, whatever, you know, just recognize how that, how your job makes you feel, and consider the possibility that via some small changes, especially changes in how you deal with your own well-being and your own needs, it can really shift the way you start dealing with your patients.
It's so profound what you're saying. So, and I'll share my own experience with that. So when you're doing the caretaking thing, you're in the curing business. You're not in the healing business.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you go into the caregiving thing, you get into the healing business. I remember as a young, you know, healer being, you know, I'd work in homeless shelters and I had my drug addict patients in the South Bronx, and I'd go to my AIDS patients and do the hospital visits and the home visits. And I would get really angry when I would come across a healer who actually was good at self-care.
Mm-hmm.
It used to piss me off. I'd be like, you selfish son of a bitch. You don't give a damn. Look what's happening. Right. It was really interesting. When somebody was healthy, would trigger a really angry response on me. Obviously, looking back, is because I didn't know how to do it. So I would also say this to people who are in a healing profession. Really pay attention. If you're getting triggered with those things, it's probably because you're actually not paying attention. And for those of us who are caretakers, we get angry when people have a healthy boundary. So part of the caretaking thing is a really weak boundary where we're very permeable. And again, it's a lose-lose situation. No one wins there.
Yeah.
And on a spiritual level, when we're in the caretaking world, the message we're giving constantly, unconsciously, is that I am the divine. I'm your higher power. And this is always going to make the person receiving, even though on the surface it looks like you're giving and they're taking.
Right.
It's going to really throw anxiety into them, because the message you're getting is like, unless I am doing this, you're not going to be cared for.
Right.
So there's also this piece, which is really reflects on our own deep unconscious beliefs. I'm alone. I'm the only one. You know, again, all the childhood woundings.
Right.
And I've said zero surrender. Go ahead.
Exactly. Surrender is the key word. And I know I've said this before, I think in another episode, but many times when working with patients who are psychotherapists or, you know, neuropsychiatrists or whatnot, the mere fact that I told them the fact that you don't have to want your patient to be better to get better. And that's counterintuitive for everybody. And it's like, the fuck you talking about? You know, I don't have to want my patients to get better, you know? And that is subtle, because it's not like you have to want them to be sick. But the moment you want them to get better, you start moving this forcing current and start creating expectation, creating pressure. Right. It's your anxiety. Our job is not to make people better. Our job is to walk by their side as they
hold space.
Correct. Yeah. Listen, be in contact, be present, and, you know, and witness basically their healing process. And it's not doing nothing. It's not doing nothing. It's about surrendering to their own healing process.
Wonderful. So you said the magical word, witness. To be witness is something that's never done. It's one thing I've learned in the most sort of helpless situations for me clinically, where I've been with really horrendous situations. And for me, just to be really present and sit with my own anxiety and feel my helplessness, literally magic would happen. Literally the light in the room would change. Literally the energetic heaviness would lift. Yeah. Because when I came, and the only time it would happen for me is when things were so horrendous.
Yeah.
You know, somebody who had AIDS and would come for treatment was going to go back to Rikers. He was getting raped daily. I mean, like horrendous stuff.
Yeah.
And me just sitting with the horror of the human condition.
Yeah.
With love, really feeling my own grief, fear, helplessness, would allow the person to take a breath.
Yeah.
Because either people didn't give a shit, 90% of it, or 10% were people like me trying to fix it.
Right.
And that never gave room to the person.
Right.
So in these moments of being with a young man dying, in these moments of these horrendous things like I described, it really was that, and I had to be forced into it. I wasn't mature enough to be like, oh, this is how it is. I remember, I believe it was R.D. Lang, one of these like, you know, really genius therapists. Somebody had come, they were filming him. Somebody had come to visit to say, hey, what does this guy do? Everyone's talking such great things about him. And he goes in a session. He just sits there and he basically listens for 45 minutes and session's over. And the interviewer was bewildered, like, what the hell did you do? And he was like, this was the work. You don't understand. It's taken decades to sit. Now, that sounds so simple, but for those people who are healers, they know how hard that is to actually sit fully. And he was very, I believe it was him. He was very sure that, like, no, being present with this person and listening, it might seem to the outsider that nothing has happened.
Yeah.
But sitting without expectation, sitting without caretaking, right, it actually shifts something.
Yeah.
As opposed to when we bring more anxiety in a room, we're also feeding their unconscious through our own unresolved unconscious. Like, whoa, 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 this is not good. You got to be anxious. That energy is really, really not good medicine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it has everything to do with how you deal with your own stuff. Because if we want to have an open heart in front of someone sharing horrendous stuff, you know, we will feel that pain with them.
Yes.
Are we willing to stay with our own pain?
There you go.
So we can stay with them in their pain, or do we want to shut down our own pain so we try to fix them and make them stop? Because you got to stop telling me this stuff. I'll give you a fix. You know, I'll give you something that'll fix you so you stop making me feel stuff I don't want to feel.
Yes. So what you said, again, is one of those profound sort of gold cases of how we can really profoundly come from people who offer curing to healing, to really trust the process. A true magic happens when we can tolerate our own unease, which then really helps us tolerate the horrendous nature of this realm at times.
Yeah.
And that aspect, as you said, uses the keyword witness.
Yeah.
It's really profound business.
Yeah.
Really profound business. And again, this all ties into this part of us that tap dances for our dinner. Right, the tap dancing can happen in your profession, can happen with your partner, can happen with your friend. It's dishonest business and it's lose-lose. A lot of times as caretakers, we feel like, oh, I gave so much and, you know, they at least they came up ahead. No, they didn't. No, they didn't. They also lose. That's tainted milk. That's tainted food.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is there anything you want to add to what we talked about?
No, I think we really gave a good view and perspective of all, you know, of all the cases. I had taken notes. There's a book that someone might be interested in, and it's by author Cynthia Orange, and it's called Take Good Care.
Yeah, it's a great book.
And in that book, you know, I found there's this diagram of about 20 points of how, you know, where would you place yourself without judgment? Notice, do you tend to do this or do you tend to do that? The difference between caretaking and caregiving. And, you know, if anybody's interested, I think that's a very...
So repeat the name again so people can...
The book is entitled Take Good Care by Cynthia Orange.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful book and it breaks it down. And again, in closing, to really pay attention to really those two words, am I caretaking? Am I caregiving?
Yeah.
To run that through the filter, get in the habit of making a little bit of room for yourself by saying, let me think about it. when someone puts a demand on you.
Yeah.
And as always, this is about, it's not it's unpleasant business, I know, to talk about. This is an invitation to actually bring more peace and joy in your life.
Yeah.
To really let go of behaviors that don't fit anymore. Yeah. This is that invitation. So in closing, I'd like to read you something. Mm-hmm. This is something I wrote, I think, 25 years ago. I don't remember now. Mm-hmm. Height of coming into the throes of my own caretaking and working on taking it to caregiving. Mm-hmm. And it's called The Royal Ass. We were born royalty. How strange to be living in a prostitute's quarters, whoring ourselves for our daily bread. It all started so slowly with the exchange of our royal cloak for an affectionate glance or stroke. The bargaining of crown jewels for a bit of acceptance. Until we were acting like a circus bear, standing on our own hind legs, groveling for food that we neither crave nor can digest, using powerful muscles that were not designed for such indignities. Since when did prince and princesses wear donkey skins and haul firewood, whack to keep in line, but a thick stick of self-forgetfulness? The tap dancing you're performing is not graceful. You're confusing anxiety with movement, numbness for joy, an acquisition with tasting. Remember that prostitutes are much more honest than you and have far more integrity in their exchange. Stop your squirming. The pain you're suffering is just the glue of the donkey skin being ripped off your back. There's only one way to stop suffering such indignities. Stop confusing the stench of a stable for your own home. Learn to live raw until your royal skin grows back.
Wow. Beautiful. So powerful. Thanks for that.
Just leave things in a little light note. For what me and you do. So here's to everyone's royal skin growing back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Welcome to the club.
Welcome to the club. Club of Rome. No. I send you so much love.
Likewise, my brother.
Till next time.
Yes. Take care.
Ciao, ciao.
Ciao, ciao, ciao.